Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to a special Christmas bumper edition of the New Statesman podcast where we're talking about the year in Brexit. This week we are joined by a special extra guest, which is Dorian Linsky of the Romaniacs podcast, which has been incredibly successful. How long ago did you guys set it up?
In May.
Yeah. And you've got like a billion squillion listeners. Like just, sweet Romaine.
We've just passed a million listens over the lifetime. Of the pod.
I have no idea how good that is. I have no idea how many listens we have.
I mean, a million sounds like quite a large number. I mean,
yeah.
In the event of a fight, right, I would feel good with a million people on my side.
I mean, these are kind of like, it's a million listeners. It's not a million distinct listeners. We have like...
Some people listen to it more than once. That
listeners.
Doesn't happen to us.
So yeah, so it's been really... Surprisingly, pleasurably.
And you're, of course, you started this podcast because you're a huge Brexiteer and you're very much in favour of Brexit. So tell us a bit more about what that's like.
there's a guy called Chopper or something who does like a pro-Brexit podcast.
Yes, it's called Chopper's Brexit podcast, I believe. That's what's his name? I can't remember.
Chris Hope.
I see what they've done
this
there.
Whole thing in the lobby of like people calling, you know, choppers and bullers and whappers and whippers and millers and mallers and...
No, okay.
I'm against it. Personally.
I know I'm against it. So Christopher Hope is the Telegraph's chief political correspondent, is Chopper. Yeah. James Chapman was Chappers. Yeah. Tim Shipman is Shippers. Jane Merrick is Merrers, at which point you begin to see the problem with this.
I'm not Linskers.
You know, no, I don't think Bush is just about works. Lewis's does not work at all. So anyway, does lots of kind of very like, ooh, I can't wait till we get that yacht.
So the producer of our show thought that you basically had all these really balanced shows about Brexit where you couldn't really kind of let loose, you couldn't be that rude, and you couldn't kind of, it was harder to be funny. And then he went, well, Chopper's whatever, he knows what his audience is and his guests, and he's got a position, and he was like, why don't we do the Remainers, not a version of his, because I've never actually heard his, but that same principle that basically you don't have to worry about balance and thinking, oh well, we mustn't offend our kind of Brexiter guests. You can kind of loosen up, and it's not like we all agree on everything. We've actually got, I mean, politically speaking, all the kind of hosts, I'm not the guests, we're kind of very different places. You can agree on this one thing, and then suddenly you just get to be kind of more relaxed and funny, and people know what they're coming for, and it's something that you're not going to get from the BBC.
I think there is a real problem with covering Brexit, is that, and it's the same problem that people had when they were covering Hillary Clinton, right? Which is that they felt bad about not having anything good to say about it, and the same way people felt bad about not having anything good to say about Donald Trump, to the extent that the New York Times started running a crazy feature. They were like, we're going to highlight one good thing that Donald Trump has done every week, you know, just to show how fair and balanced we are. And that's my, I guess that is one of my problems with Brexit, is that I don't have a lot of nice things to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit like that meme that you occasionally see when kind of a journalist, like, and I'm not going to pretend I have never done this, has a snit about like, oh, this, you know, look at these two divergent responses to the same article. And we go like, oh, well, if both sides are having a go at you, you must be doing something right. And it's like, no, there are...
It might just be bad in a number of ways.
Yeah, there's actually an infinitesimal number of issues in which the ground truth is, you know, in some kind of point of equidistant, right? Even if you, you know, kind of, I mean, let's say, like, I don't know, the mixed economy, right? The mixed economy does not mean that, like, no state at all plus nationalize everything That isn't actually a kind of like, oh, well, we're somewhere in between these two things, because the argument for a mixed economy, and I am just using this as an example, please do not send me long screeds in favour of, you know, of no state at all, or you know, holding the commanding height.
I'm going to phone you up every day over Christmas and read out Atlas Shrugged to you.
But
hi, Stephen. It's 10 o'clock. Time for your three-page Atlas Shrugged.
But the point is, the argument for the mixed economy is not, oh, well, you know, the truth is something in between. It's actually, no state doesn't work. There are some things that the state is not effective at running, right? It's not a like, oh, both sides kind of nonsense. And I think that's been particularly problematic with Brexit. I think it's in the US, it feels like it's been a problem of kind of years in the making. We see it with the Republican tax plan, right? Where just objectively, it expands the deficit. Objectively, it is a massive transfer of wealth to the richest, paid for, such as you can claim it's paid for by increasing the tax of the poorest.
I think it's a response to the anti-media age as well, right? Which is about the fact that so much of the work of politicians, and actually I put Jeremy Corbyn in this bracket as well, although some people might say he has better reason for this, is it has been about diffusing criticism by delegitimizing it from the start in a kind of way you would say that, wouldn't you, kind of thing. So I know that I'm very conscious whenever I make a criticism of Jeremy Corbyn on Twitter, I couch it much more in like, we all know he's done some good things, he's very popular, but whereas if Theresa May does something bad, I will just go, this is a terrible idea by Theresa May, right?
I think the problem you've got with BBC or New York Times is that you've got a lot of very sort of clever, conscientious journalists that are so insistent on balance, to the point that, like with some of the coverage of the tax plan, that they've confused sort of opinion and facts. And it's like, well, you can have balanced opinion, but you can't have balanced sort of facts. And if all you're saying is, well, the Republicans say it's great, and the Democrats say it's a transfer of wealth to the rich, and you never actually say, but the facts show this, because that would be sort of taking a side, then you are actually sort of letting down your readers and your listeners. It's like, you do have to serve the public by drawing a line sometimes between opinion and facts, and let everybody's voice be heard, but don't pretend that it's kind of like this just, it's like standing in front of a kind of, the tax bill is like a piece of abstract art, and it's just like, well, hey man, it's whatever you get out of it. It's like, there are actual facts.
But the reason that they do that, I think, is that particularly in the case of the BBC, they're so worried about being seen as culturally Remain. And that's kind of, I mean, maybe something we should talk about more, about the way that Brexit has become a proxy for a kind of US-style culture war about graduates, about an ethnically diverse younger population, about people who are more at ease with globalization or multiculturalism, whatever it might be, right? And so the big question for the year, I don't know what you think about this, Stephen. Nick Timothy, formerly co-chief of staff for Theresa May, was complaining on Twitter that her Citizens of Nowhere line in her conference speech was not about actually about Europe. It was about international global financial elites that didn't have any allegiance to any specific country. And I said, well, I think it was framed a bit by that Daily Mail front page, which was clearly obviously the result of some briefing by May's team that said, you know, May savages liberal elite. But the point about that is, I think that there was a tactical decision taken before the election about prosecuting Brexit as a proxy culture war in order to win back UKIP voters, basically, and a lot of the rhetoric around it was that. Was that always going to happen? Or could you have prosecuted Brexit as a purely bureaucratic, technical box-ticking exercise and not imputed all those extra meanings onto it?
I think once you commit to the interpretation of the referendum result that Theresa May has, which actually, you know, my unpopular opinion is I think that is a broadly correct analysis of why people voted to leave, right? They wanted out of
free movement. One wanted to leave the customs union, come on.
Oh no, so the customs union bit, I'm going to park. The customs union thing is just a you know, a fringe preoccupation of a very small number of conservatives. But actually the thing about leaving the customs union is, although it makes the Irish border much more fraught, which is why it's a silly thing to do, although it hurts the economy long term, because ultimately we will never make up the loss of trade from piggybacking on the EU's trade deals, then yeah, the sums will never ever work for leaving the customs union. However, it's not actually that drastic or immediate an economic, yeah, in terms of the kind of hardness of your Brexit, the leaving of the single market is just a much bigger deal. So I think it is a fair enough argument that the referendum result was about the single market. I just think if you pretend it was, what were the arguments about immigration, payments, etc. about, if not participation in the single market? That to me is a good reason to oppose it. And if you're an MP, to say, well, look, you can vote how you want, but if you vote for me, I'm not voting to make everyone poorer. You know, sozzles, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough.
But could you leave the single market in a technocratic way without having to
I think once you have interpreted the referendum result in that way, a large chunk of people who voted Conservative happily in 2015, 2010, et cetera, are going to be worse off because that version of Brexit. Of that chunk, for a large chunk of them, their European membership, their free movement rights are part of their identity. Mm. So if you're the Conservative Party, you do need to get votes from somewhere else. I do think kind of the, I think, yeah, although May made a lot of mistakes this year, I think two of her insights were essentially correct. One is what the referendum mandate is about. The second is, if you accept that first part, the Conservative Party has to get more votes from somewhere. So they were always going to have to go like culture war-y and weird. However, if you are a Brexiteer, it's the worst mistake that they could ever have made. Because even if Brexit turns out to be immensely successful economically, which I think is unlikely, but let's just roll with it, the long-term threat to Brexit that I think is not going to go away and is only going to get worse is the right has turned it into a cultural proxy, which means that even if it succeeds, Brexit will always be bad.
This is the interesting thing about the comparison with the US, right, is that actually smart Republicans, a generation, well, like a political generation ago, were worried about the kind of way that the US demographics were going and about whether or not actually just appealing to overt white racial resentment was really a long-term strategy in a country that would be majority-minority within, 10 or 20 years. Dorian, your question for the end of your roundup is, who is your favourite, by which I mean obviously least favourite, Brexiteer?
It sort of has to be, I mean, it's probably Aaron Banks, because he's just such a thug about it. I think he's one of those sort of figures where you're just thinking this is such, it's like a cigarette paper between him and the far right, and how its tone in like tonally, if you look at the leave.eu.
Oh, no, I'm the only reason I'm raising my eyebrows is I don't think there's even a cigarette paper.
Oh, right.
I mean, you're getting.
I thought I was being unfair to Banksy there.
No, I think he very much, you know, they put out leave.eu, which was an organisation he was involved with, put out a video clip where kind of showed a female journalist being, whatever it was, slapped, right? I mean, they're not flirting with, you know, more than flirting with images of violence at this point.
Yeah, they are not flirting. They have taken it home.
They've bought it dinner. Yeah. They've introduced it to their mother.
Well, the disappointment is, you know, without being sort of both sidesy, is that I do feel like in order to kind of, you know, make your arguments better, you want to kind of test them against the best arguments on the other side. And we've often talked on our podcast about like, well, you know, can we find a sensible Brexity type that could come on 1 week? And it's just, it's relentlessly disappointing that every, you know, it doesn't matter who it is, if it's Daniel Hannan or, you know, Julia Hartley Brewer just depresses the sort of hell out of me, because it's this sort of, they all have this kind of, it can't just be stupidity. I mean, I'd imagine there are things that they don't understand about Brexit, but so if it's not just stupidity, then it's this sort of gross dishonesty, constantly misrepresenting, you know, the facts, expanding the mandate beyond even what Stephen was talking about. It's very, very hard to kind of to respect your opponents when they just seem so sort of relentlessly dishonest and or sort of crass and sort of, you know, belligerently racist in some cases. It's just like it is sort of dismaying. And I never felt that way as a Labour man. I never really felt that way about the Conservative Party en masse. There were always Conservative MPs I could find. I go, well, I obviously disagree with you, but you appear to have some respect for the truth and sort of decency, and you're not calling people that disagree with you traitors.
I think what gets to me is the sleight of hand. And actually, in a way, I don't mind the Aaron Banks swing so much, because at least you know what they are and they're upfront about what they are and what their objectives are. For me, the key piece in the whole referendum debate is that Matthew Paris column about Daniel Hannan, in which he says, you know, he knows that his version of Brexit, which is all based about sovereignty, could have got about 10 to 15% of the vote. You know, he knows the tiger he rides. And I think that's the type of Brexiteer I find it most hard to deal with, because I believe that they're fundamentally selling a thing that they want under the cover of something that they don't really care about, but and not worrying about. I'm talking about immigration here, right? I'm talking about the fact that you I don't think that Dominic Cummings is particularly worried about immigration as an issue of itself. I think his insight was that this was the issue that would win, that would tip them over into a majority for the referendum. So they needed to really play on that with very little thought for the consequences of what that would do to national discourse beyond winning a campaign. And that's what I find. Those are the Brexiteers I find it hardest to deal with, because I think, was it worth it? Is a trade deal with America worth what you've done to poison kind of national discourse?
Well, that's it, because if you look at America, I think, you know, that is, you know, they're a few years down the line in this direction. And I'm sort of really terrified about massive polarization, about kind of just, you know, large scale organized lying, incredible rancor. And the idea that you can sort of play with a culture war to achieve a short term goal, or even what, you know, so May's doing, or using culture war to get some voters. And it's like we've literally got this enormous test case across the Atlantic, which shows that this is appalling, and it sort of ruins politics. And the way that people can be so cavalier about stoking those fires, I just find dismaying. It seems utterly irresponsible and dishonest, and it's going to kind of hurt everybody.
There are some advocates of Brexit now who I think are saying sort of interesting and thoughtful things. Ben Kelly, who blogs as The Skeptic Isle.
Ian Martin, I read as what somebody who I think I disagree with you on a lot of stuff, but I fundamentally don't think you're a bad person.
He has started to get like a little bit enemies of the people, though. Mm.
But then I think, do you know what? I just think this is the way particularly online discourse goes, right? I mean, you absolutely see it on the left as well, right? Is that you cannot have an opinion about Jeremy Corbyn that does not lead to massive rancor on one or both sides. Like, there are just some subjects that are now just have got, that just are radioactive, right?
Yeah. The thing I have found maddening over the last year is the refusal to engage with, the point, it's coming, we'll go, it'll be fine, we'll just end up in EFTA. And you're just like, but people who voted to leave expecting, much stronger borders.
And more money for the NHS.
And more money for the NHS. When they don't get what they want out of EFTA, who are they going to blame? And it feels as if the Dan Hannans of the world have broadly either not thought about it or have decided that the people who will be blamed for that aren't them and aren't people they
know, hang out,
have any personal sympathy with. Yeah, it's kind of like, I completely agree with the argument. I don't get why your Roland Smiths think that the EEA is not an unacceptable loss of sovereignty, but EU membership is. But if you want to leave the EU and but want to retain if you're like yes to the common market, no to the political project, fine. And that is a way of leaving the EU that doesn't harm the economy, etc., etc. However, if you have just voted for the side which went, the Turks are coming, this idea that there won't be some kind of political reaction to people who do not look like the average EEA leaver is for the birds. And there does need to be some attempt at least to stand up and defend their own kind of, because the problem throughout Europe, right, is not just the rise of the nativist right. It is the catastrophic failure of the center right to even defend, actually, to be honest, even acknowledge the existence of its own
apart
border.
From in France, right? I mean, that's the kind of counterexample.
Wacky as, unlike Fionn, right, did do a kind of like a very mimsy sort of like JLM did. He did a kind of very mimsy kind of like, don't vote,
So this is Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who's the communist candidate,
the far left candidate, but the new leader of the French centre-right, currently called the Republicans, but, who knows what they're...
But didn't denounce Marine Le Pen in the same terms that you got the mainstream centre-right during the presidential election, which is what helped Macron to win.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
But that, to me, is that not the essence of populism? And that's why I've ended the year feeling more pessimistic about politics than I have for a really long time, because I feel that a lot of sides are trafficking in populism, in simple sloganeering, and in the idea of a nebulous enemy who is kind of there to be fought, you know, this very kind of oppositional style, in a way that does not acknowledge that most politics is about incremental change, compromise, you know, cooperation, and everybody getting a little bit of what they want.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the real enemy at the moment, that it's not so much a kind of left-right thing. It's just this kind of, you have to, you know, why I, for example, can't stand a site like Squawkbox. It's not because I particularly, you know, have a problem with its politics per se. It's just, it's the way that it just thinks that that kind of basically becoming like a propaganda channel is sort of okay as long as it's in favor of Corbyn. And I feel like the big message for me of this year, you know, from all the kind of, you know, Russia investigations and analysis of kind of, you know, bots on Twitter and the general political rhetoric in Britain and America, is like, well, that's the sort of danger of this sort of sweeping populism and sort of denouncing your enemies and, you know, seeing any kind of compromise and any of the kind of things that, you know, that often make politics work and make it not bloody and hideous, are just kind of unacceptable. And I feel like that whole direction that things are moving in, quite apart from what happens with, how Brexit manifests, is that what the referendum kind of revealed and the kind of division that revealed and then intensified is the massive problem. You know, whether or not we end up being in the customs union or not is important economically, but there's this huge cultural problem with our politics that is not seemingly being addressed by people in power.
How new do you think that actually is? I mean, to me, the other example of a time that this reminds me of is the way that the newspapers particularly reacted in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, right? When you had kind of Charlie Kennedy's a rat and his dartboard and these snakes who were unpatriotic. And that kind of, that is the closest analogue I can think in my lifetime of a time when dissent was itself seen as unpatriotic. And I guess it's one of the things that unionists complain about in Scotland, that any kind of criticism of the SNP is framed as talking Scotland down, and why don't you believe in Scotland? But there does seem to have been a big move, particularly, you know, on both sides actually now, about the most kind of highest class journalism you can do is to support something rather than to stand slightly aside from it and analyse it critically.
And I suppose maybe that's, you know, part of what we're talking about, this sort of failure of kind of chronic both sidesism, is that some people just think, well, the response for that is to be a super strong advocate, you know, because it's almost like, it's like the sort of failure of certain models of centrism makes some people think that the center is just pointless. And maybe that's what's happening with sort of journalistic centrism. You know,
well, there's a horrifying term.
You've got these two extreme choices, really.
Yeah, so I actually feel more optimistic at the end of 2017 than I did at the start. Partly because I worried at the start of 2017 that, you know, I would have been vaporized by Donald Trump by now.
And I mean, that could still happen, Stephen.
Yeah, but a whole, you know,
however
many days.
A whole year of going to Kew Gardens and posting Instagram pictures of tea.
He's been president for literally a whole calendar year by the time our listeners. And I am not, at time of speaking,
vapor.
It's a good low bar you've set yourself.
So obviously there are problems of kind of erosions of democratic norms. You know, the fact that, as far as I can tell, no one seems to quit their jobs anymore, even when they really ought to. All of which are...
Well, hang on a minute. Pay a moment's silence for Priti Patel, who
quit her job eventually.
I mean, it took a long time and it just was... I mean, it was bad. And actually, Michael Fallon as well. But you're talking about Boris, aren't you, really? Boris
I'm
Johnson.
Talking about Boris and Davis.
£2 in the Boris jar, but yeah.
Sorry, I'm talking about Johnson and Davis. yeah, so I am deeply troubled by the erosion of some quite important norms. But ultimately, at the start of this year, it felt that a person with, you know, deeply troubling attitudes towards, you know, democratic oversight, power of the state, etc., was about to be handed a great deal of power. We actually have a situation where, even though good faith consensus-based politics is still very much not Theresa May's natural instinct, she's kind of been forced into it anyway. I do think, to do my habit of being one of those really boring electoral reform people, that the problem of a system designed around adversarialism and kind of going, maybe the truth is just this weird equidistant point between, you know, maybe the customs union is, maybe what we need to be is be half in, half out the customs union. Which the second you have a kind of, you are forced to build a coalitions, you know, in parliament and not just, you know, in through first past the post, you have to actually talk about policy trade-offs a bit more. So I think all of those forces are still, you know, very negative. But, you know, 2017 did not live up to my fears, and some of those forces have had their flank turned. It does feel like we might be heading towards a slightly less disastrous Brexit.
Who'll get you, Mr. Optimist? I am worried that I think there is a real problem about the kind of boiling frog thesis, and I think that's where that was what particularly worries me about politics at the moment. And I think it's actually ultimately what worries me about Brexit is that the way that I see it developing now is as something that is a slow erosion. We will just get less rich every year. The economy will grow at a much slower rate. It will be crapper in a way that is very hard to definitively point to. That person lost their job because this happened. And that's a very complicated thing to engage with, because obviously what you don't want is a massive, huge cliff edge and a huge shock in which, you know, half the country ends up not being able to feed themselves. But equally well, it's very hard to make a political project out of saying things are just slightly less good than they could have been. And I see the same thing, I feel like, is what's happening in Eastern Europe, is you are just getting a slow and steady erosion of democratic norms. Hungary and Poland are both in very bad places, I would say, and rapidly getting worse. And maybe I've just, like I say, I've read a lot of things about the 1930s and this year for other reasons. And it just feels like, look, always the question I had going into that is, did people in the 1930s know they were living through the 1930s? Like, do people know when the frog is getting slightly warmer, or do you only notice when the frog dies?
I've been reading a lot about the 1930s for research as well.
Cheery, yeah.
I mean, on the one hand, it makes you feel slightly better because it's like, wow, that really was a stinker of a decade. Like, this is better than that. But yeah, still this sort of sense of it's odd how many times you can come across a line. I mean, I'm reading like a lot of sort of Orwell's journalism, and you can come across a line and just go, yeah, we should probably pay attention to that now. Just the idea of not taking, you know, they were saying like, well, people didn't take Hitler seriously enough. And just because somebody seems like a laughable figure when they start out, they might become dangerous. I completely ignored that, like a lot of people, you know, with the sort of rise of Trump. It was just like, well, he's just ridiculous and people won't go for that. And there are a few too many sort of echoes. And I don't think it's like we're on the sort of cusp of totalitarianism. But there's still this kind of inability to know what to do with these sort of raging tides of populism and to sort of predict how stuff that sensible people, Orwell's whole line about 1930s is like, this is no time for sensible people. It goes, the future belongs to the lunatics, not the sensible people. And you come in with a very kind of logical sort of model of like, well, I don't think this is going to happen. And I think people will push back if it gets too far. And it's not necessarily true.
I think the parallel that most alarms me is obviously the great worldwide financial crash of the late 2028-29, and the way that that then tips into a lot of rhetoric about essentially the same things you're hearing now about the international unaccountable elites and the 1%, the 1930s version of that, which then bleeds into, oh, actually, it turns out everyone was talking about Jews. And I think that that's why I know so many Jewish people who are particularly worried about the rise of anti-Semitism now, because it is mixed into an idea that is completely broadly accepted and is a thesis with lots of merit about the idea about the way that global finance is disconnected from the countries in which it operates. But that boundary has always been quite porous. And I think that feels very dangerous. About, do we know when some people undoubtedly, I mean, Godfrey Bloom, the UKIP former MEP, started talking about Goldman Sachs as a Jewish banker. And I think that's the point at which you think, hang on a minute, are we all talking about the same thing? There's a brilliant piece in John Ronson's book, Them, about extremists, where he talks about, I think it's when he goes to visit David Icke, right? And he sort of says, I just need to know whether or not when he says lizards, he means Jews. And I can't get this out of him. I need to do it. And I feel a bit like that when I hear sometimes talk on the far left and far right about international elites. I kind of want to go, what are you actually talking about here?
There obviously is a deeply troubling resurgence of anti-Semitism in the sphere, particularly actually in continental Europe. And I'm not anti-Semitic. Well, there is a resurgence of troubling anti-Semitism in continental Europe, particularly if you look at what's happening with protests on behalf of the law and justice government in Poland. In continental Europe, there is also a troubling rise of virulent Islamophobia and hostility towards migration from, you know, from across the Mediterranean, which I think a lot of British politicians are going, oh, well, these people have concerns about free movement too. And it's just like, actually, they don't. You haven't really understood what these very real concerns are. Yeah, I thought David Runciman's lecture that they did on the Talking Politics podcast about, you know, in the 30s, you know, the global population was significantly younger, right? And you do kind of need a groundswell of, you know, angry young people in order to trigger this. In the places where you have angry young people, you are having revolutions, admittedly, and mostly in the case of the Arab Spring revolutions, which are ending in
authoritarian,
in a general winter. Yeah. But despite all of that, I do feel like 2017... was a year in which there was a slight turning back from some of those forces.
Yeah, well, you get Roy Moore losing in Alabama, for example. Yeah. You know, you get Macron's win in France, whatever you think about him, that was a defeat of a far-right candidate that would have been a really terrible sign. And also, yeah, I know what you mean, in the sense that what happened with Trump is, to America's liberals, an enormous wake-up call that you cannot be smug and complacent and assume that, you know, liberal democracy is the final form of human society and it's won. You know, these are things that need to be constantly renewed. Doreen, why don't you finish off by telling us someone who has impressed you in 2017 so we can end on a happy, joyous note. Who's nice? Who's on Santa's nice list this year?
Who's impressed me? I mean, I do. I mean, I know that there's sort of various criticisms to be made of him, but I do find that Sadiq Khan gives me a general sense of well-being. He often says the right things at the right time. You know, you wouldn't want at this point Boris... I mean, maybe you'd want Boris Johnson out of the Foreign Office. But I think Boris Johnson, if he was mayor of London now, would...
I think it's an astonishing thing to have a Muslim mayor of London who has always made such a point of going to Hanukkah services, of going to, you know, Christmas services, of being both utterly London and utterly ecumenical. I mean, I'm not a very faith-based person myself, but I do think at this moment, particularly when, like Stephen was saying, about Islamophobia being this incredibly virulent disease, somebody who is absolutely... you know, out there making the case that Islam can coexist with other religions, which is something that the far right was very keen to suggest cannot be the case.
But this is, I mean, he's dealing with those various forms of prejudice. He's very strongly, you know, pro-EU. He just seems to be, if we're talking about this kind of the direction of travel that we find worrying, and he seems like a very strong figure kind of pushing back against those, which I think is sort of almost disconnected from maybe sort of individual kind of policy things. I'm not kind of like, you know, reporting on City Hall and finding out, you know, I'm sure when by the time he leaves office,
he hasn't,
you know,
done a lot on air quality.
People will point to sort of certain failures, and he didn't go far enough here, and he broke his promise on that. So it's not that he's sort of this perfect politician, but in a year when I think I've been more dismayed by politics than at any point, notwithstanding kind of Labour's, you know, election surprise, can't seem somebody that I can at least have some faith in. You know, for now.
Well, that's a happy Christmas note to end on. Thank you very much, Doreen Litsky, for joining us.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Helen Lewis. It's recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our music is by the Underscore Orchestra. That's the last you'll hear from us this year. We'll be back in the first week of January, and a very Merry Christmas to all of you at home.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.